Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, true crime fans. It's Wayne Klingman of The Milwaukee Mob. And we're here today with another show. I really appreciate people listening. Last few shows we had on the different people involved in our film, Hold Card. And we have more people from that film will be on as well. But we have the opportunity to bring on one of my first guests I've ever had the pleasure to bring on the Milwaukee Mob podcast when it started. Yes, in fact, please stand and applaud for the best-looking man in all of crime fiction. No, I correct myself. True crime. He is a god, in fact. I'm so awed by his presence, I simply had my memory erased and have to reload my memory capsules. So let's have a good Rojan cheer for the famous, the incredibly good-looking, the best-selling author in all days to come, the one true famous, Robert Sabrina. Good morning, sir. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for that lead-in. That was awesome. I'm doing well.
Outstanding. So we have to let's touch base with you just for a second here before we go on. In the past, you came on and you talked about the really, really interesting books that you read. I apologize. I don't know why my brain is shutting off. I do apologize for that. Usually it's more active this. And I'm just fascinated. How did you get involved in writing true crime in the first place? It's such a fascinating subject.
Well, a lot of it has to do with there's research involved. So generally it ends up being geographically convenient to you unless you're – because you're not going to – there's not a lot of money in it unless you get to a certain level. There's a couple authors that specialize in it. M. William Phelps, a couple of people like that, Ann Rule. But other than that, you just have to find a crime that occurred close to you so that you can actually do the legwork and do that research, number one. Number two, a lot of door knocking and phone calling. You have to be the type of individual who does not mind reaching out to people and doesn't care about getting hung up on and yelled at and so forth. That's a big part of it. It's what keeps most people out of that genre, I think, because you're talking to people who may have lost a family member or people that, you know, may have been close to a crime, and law enforcement. And all three of those entities, in some cases, just don't want to talk to you. So you have to have kind of a strong constitution.
Sure.
Now, one of the barriers that doesn't exist for it is you don't have to be a great writer. The story is key in these cases. That's what the enthusiasts of this type of field like is they just want a story. So nobody has to be a great writer here. That's what editors are for. research and reaching out to people. If you got those two qualities, you're in.
I mean, I've read and enjoyed all your books. I'm as fascinated with the amount of details that they offer. They had to have written, taken you quite the amount of time to write.
Well, they did. They did, because nonfiction, it's kind of an interesting animal because it's research, it's fact-based. It's resource-oriented, but it's also, in a sense, creative nonfiction because you have to get in the heads of victims and the killer. And the audience needs that. They don't mind you doing that. For example, they're formulaic. Most books start out with, a young woman on a dark road, had a flat tire, for example, and she's walking to help. And a guy picks her up, and unfortunately, yeah, it's a serial killer. And you're going to tell the last seconds of her life, what she was thinking when she died. Now, of course, we can't know what she was thinking, but your readers, you know, they don't mind. They want you to get inside of her head. They want you to show the terror she might have felt. And then that sets the tone for the rest of the book.
Sure. Sure. About that brave policeman from Ohio that you wrote the book about, you know, you tell this story in a no-nonsense tone that made me want to read more and more and more. And if El Paso meet the man, that was a great job of writing above and beyond most books I read anymore.
That book, thank you, Wayne. That book almost wrote itself a little bit. It started out at the time that I wrote that book a couple years ago. There were quite a few police-involved shootings. Michael Brown. There was a case in Cleveland, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old that got shot by police. So I really wanted to explore police-involved shootings and use one subject, the cop that I interviewed, because he had killed five people in line of duty. But, you know, his story, because he'd been in Vietnam and he was a good storyteller, it really ended up being more story about him. And fortunately, he was a very good communicator, and he was able to give me quite a bit of information. So a lot of that book took place in Vietnam when he was younger. And, you know, I almost wish I could have kept the book in Vietnam, actually, because that's non-controversial. But, you know, a police officer who kills five people in line of duty, maybe not such a popular subject these days. And I didn't really get to – I did explore the dynamics of a police-involved shooting, why it happens, how we might be able to prevent it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, from talking to that police officer and others that have been involved in shootings, you know, it's so hard to know what you would do if you're not in that situation. It sounds cliche. But every cop will say, if you weren't there, you don't know what you'd do. And I really came to believe that. How many of us
true.
Have
I mean,
really had a gun pointed at us?
Right. How can you ever think those thoughts and have that split second, I have to do something now?
Correct. And even though cops are trained, they're armed, they're still human. They still feel
right.
fear, and fear is contagious.
Right. I mean, I would be terrified. I mean, I was in the military. I was in the military, and I was taught to use a weapon, right? But I can't imagine the terror I would be in as a policeman, potentially alone by myself in a dark alley, perhaps in a basement someplace, with some crazy guy with a gun that has already maybe killed someone, might be out to kill me. What the hell do you do?
Well, yeah, and in the military, you know what happens if you don't shoot first. And sometimes, you know, back in the 70s, after the Vietnam War, police departments liked that type of individual, military guy, because he understood hierarchy, regimentation. He was trainable. But they were aggressive, these individuals. Now maybe police departments aren't really looking for that individual as much, that aggressive individual. They're looking for more negotiators, somebody that'll wait, you know, and plan before they, you know, really take action.
Yeah,
my guy was the epitome. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I apologize for cutting you off, sir.
The individual I wrote about was the epitome of aggressiveness. First through
right.
the door. First with the weapon drawn.
Yeah,
now
yes,
the thinking is, and even he would admit, you know, maybe that's not what police departments are looking for anymore.
It is a time for I expect everything, really. Depending if it's a small town police officer pulling over a drunk driver, maybe. In my neighborhood, we have very bad people running the streets. And if should I have to call 911, I don't want a negotiator knocking on my door saying it's okay for him to come in. If my wife and I are in danger, I want the officer that I'm entrusting to protect me and mine and my wife and my wife's life to be coming through that door to save me.
Mm-hmm. Controversial no-knock entrances. Things go bad there. There is one situation where police cities have changed their policies, and that is school shootings. If there's an active shooter in a school, the thinking used to be, wait, get the supervisors there, formulate a plan, now they realize all they're doing is exposing students to being killed, like Columbine. Now they want officers just to go in. Just go in immediately. Try to neutralize the situation.
Right. I mean, things have changed and situations changed. I'm sure training's changed too. I expect out with drones and all these surveillance cameras that are around buildings and buildings, that might give the police officers more intelligence to know what they're facing before they show up.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Technology is really making an impact with the body cameras, for example.
Right. Absolutely.
Now that's good and bad though. You know, there's accountability and transparency, but now there's also privacy issues. With private citizens having their, their lives recorded, that's going to be an issue down the road.
Yes, I know here, I think some of the officers have body cameras. I don't know if they all do or not. And already it's been a couple of issues with discussed in the courts as if somebody has the rights violated because they're being approached by an officer. But again, that's what we have courts for and figure it out. But yes, at the same time, as we just briefly off there, in my opinion, we have a string for how it's going on with innocent people being killed by police officers. And I think everybody would like that to go away.
Yeah, law enforcement in the modern day, it's a very much a give-and-take proposition. We want to be protected. We want to be safe. Yet it seems like we're far less tolerant of police making mistakes.
Right.
We don't want that, yet we want them out there risking their lives. And it's the police, in Cleveland, for example, there's been high-profile shootings here, and 60 police have left the force in the past year. Because of the high-profile shootings in Cleveland, particularly the Tamir Rice case, he was a 12-year-old who was shot by two police. They thought he had a real gun. He had a toy gun. Department of Justice came in and made some sweep mandates, and police are saying, hey, we don't know if we can operate safely under these mandates. So we haven't had a situation yet in Baltimore with after the Freddie Gray case, the individual who was shot, found dead in a van, the mayor came down out of the police department there and the police went on a stand down. They did that in New York also for a while where they didn't make any arrests. Well, Baltimore's murder rates skyrocketed and it hurt everybody, but who it hurt most was business people in those neighborhoods because now they were fair game for crime. And that didn't help anybody.
No, it didn't. And so to say in Milwaukee, we're averaging one or two killings a week, and we don't have the numbers of police that are mandated. And the police chief's idea to solve problems in the street is to buy an ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck.
And the idea would be.
Go ahead.
I know the idea.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
If he takes his ice cream truck down the neighborhoods and make nights with the kids, they'll help not do the crimes. And it's all stems with the problem that we have with the courts is because we have DAs that won't prosecute. Or instead of putting the guy, say they catch a bad guy and they get him for a couple of felonies, they'll give him some jail time. They're putting in some program that won't serve any jail time at all, which is also going to go back and commit more and more crimes until finally he's killed someone or maybe two people.
In Cleveland, we had a problem with young people in crime and using motorcycles and being illegal with motorcycles. So the mayor decided to build a $2 million dirt track for kids to ride motorcycles on. Yet, how are they going to get the motorcycle there? It's just a real Band-Aid on the situation.
The nice thing that we have, in my opinion, getting back to the topic at hand more than drifting, I apologize for, is because we have access of good books written by great authors like you that talk about the importance of police work, the importance of how a crime is solved, what leads up to a crime, what makes a person into a mass murderer, a killer, a serial killer. You know, that love helps people like me make decisions based on facts versus make decisions based on what we see in a 3-second TV bite.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I thank you for that. Boy, that's a very meaty topic, too. I mean, we can go off in a lot of different directions on that.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to leave that up to you, whichever way you want to, whichever direction you want to pursue
that
on.
Because that's the value why I want to encourage people, as we talked again off the air, about getting involved in writing true crime stories, even in the form of fiction, is the more we know, the better judgments we can make. Because I want the facts. I want the facts versus, again, if I read a book, your book, someone else's book, right? Like, are you familiar with Mr. Wilson's book? He started a bunch of drug books. He wrote The Cartel, The Day of the Dog. Okay. I mean, it's political, especially The Cartel is very much politically based. You know exactly when he thinks of the war on drugs. You know exactly why he gets that point. His books are fiction, but any reader of the news today, and I'm sure we both are and then some, we see where he gets his information. The war on drugs and horrific amount of casualties. It's spawning everything from illegal immigration to high rates of crime. And if we don't understand how that works, how can we make the right decisions or come to any decision? So the more information we have in book form or magazine articles, in my opinion, the better off we are.
Well, Winslow, I like what he's doing. He writes novels that focus on these type of social criminal issues, and by dramatizing them and making them stories, he gathers a bigger audience and makes them more aware of these situations. Yeah, I think that's very effective.
Yep.
My book, of course, was nonfiction, and I did – see, the thing with the nonfiction, too, getting back to anybody who wants to write true crime, okay, they're going to have to understand that it's still not to be callous, because in my case, 11 people died in that story, but it is still show business, if
yes.
You don't mind me saying that. You still have to entertain the reader while you're educating the reader. You have to compel them to keep turning pages. So there's a little bit of art there. You can't just put fact after fact after fact. That's boring. You got to weave a narrative, a story. Winslow does that very well. And also the other thing is you're well-meaning, you're altruistic, you want to address social issues. But with the true crime genre, you can't get too involved in the social issues, because the reader is looking for action in a lot of cases. My
right.
book, in House of Horrors, the social issue I addressed was the impact of drugs. And what drugs had to do with the situation. All 11 women that Anthony Sowell, the serial killer that I documented, his victims were drug users. And that's how, he would lure them to his house. Well, crack cocaine, the drug then of choice, readily available, cheap. Some would say that it started in California. The government was allowing it to come in, the CIA in return for some things that were going on there. But,
yep.
I just tried to say that maybe our drug programs aren't working. Maybe we need more money allocated towards rehabilitation and drug control. But, you got to weave that stuff in sparingly, because people don't want to get preached at. They want a story.
Right. Right, the winner story, right. And it takes a very good writer to illustrate some of the background, say someone's troubled past, say situations that the victim faced, why they got involved in this situation, a horrific situation in the first place. It does take a talent, because you want to You don't want to blame the victim for something they cannot help happening to them, something they did not seek to happen. And at the same time, crime has many facets. There's a reason why it happened to this person at this particular time. Maybe it's the wrong place at the wrong time. Most of the time that might be the case when it comes to a serial killer. But these other crimes, like the Lusitania heist, has far more than that, isn't it?
Well, you know, Wayne, you're making very astute observations. You're absolutely right. Because if you really analyze even a serial killer's victims, in a lot of cases, it's not really people that were unrelated or innocent to the killer. In most cases, there are people that travel in the same orbit as the killer. In other
right.
words, my 11 victims were drug users. They were women who, because of their drug use, abandoned their children. They resorted to crime, whether it was prostitution or stealing. They put themselves in a position to be on the same level as the killer. So, however, that doesn't mean, of course, they deserve to be killed. So
right.
you still want to be empathetic to the victims. You want to show that they are flawed, though, like us all. You know, we're all flawed as humans. But,
right.
You have to try to separate their faults from who they are as people. You know, they're
right.
Don't define them by their, you know, their shortcomings as people.
Right, simply because, in our example, you might remember the Long Island killings, right? I still don't think they caught the person that's responsible for those women being killed, right? Because
right.
the women are involved in drugs and those women are involved in prostitution, do that merit being killed? But yet, because they're prostitutes and because they're involved somewhat in the crime of the drug life crimes, right? Are the police
mm-hmm.
doing everything they can do to solve those killings when you have the cute blonde girl scenario down the street? Like, that was quite the rage. Why is it that the cute blonde women get all the attention when they go missing versus the young black American girl who doesn't make it home from school?
Absolutely. In House of Horrors, that trial took place after the Soul's trial. It was a capital trial. Took place in 2011. There were 11 black women that he killed. It was very, very high profile when the trial started out early summer of August of 2011. Now, as the trial progressed, all those TV cameras, all those national, international news agencies started leaving the trial and heading down to Florida, because at the time, one of the biggest murder trials we've ever seen was occurring down there, and that was Casey Anthony.
Right.
So, Casey, you know, attractive woman,
yep.
White woman, okay? Well, what happened in Cleveland was the families of the 11 black women were angry, and they did stage somewhat of a protest up here saying, wait a minute. You got 11 black women up here, the media doesn't care about it anymore because you got a cute, attractive woman, white woman in Florida. And,
yep.
you know, to an extent, you can see their, you know, you can see their viewpoint there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, well, and the journal's viewpoint, too, because their editors are going to send them to a story that they either sell newspapers on or get people to watch the shows on.
Yeah, the Casey Anthony story, that was a game changer. That changed coverage of those kind of trials because it was one of the first cases to incorporate social media. It was covered, you know, on Twitter and Facebook. And so it kind of crossed over from mainstream media into social media. And also, you know, networks turned it into kind of an entertainment story, really, with the updates and the way they covered it. It was almost glamorized, which
right.
didn't, yeah, it was really a crossover there from news to almost entertainment, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting.
It was very
and
interesting.
We had, then Cleveland had another case a couple years later, the Ariel Castro case, where he kidnapped three women, kept them in his house for 10 years. Now, they escaped. He wasn't a killer. He was a collector. in that case was very much covered both as a news and also in a sense as a media event. Yeah. You know, you had young girls, I don't want to single out any of them, but one was an attractive woman. In fact, now she's got a job at a TV station doing some entertainment blurbs. But yeah, that was interesting also. That covered was covered worldwide, like no other case. We knew those three women's names. We knew a lot about them. We really didn't know much about the black victims, African-American women that Anthony Sowell killed. In fact, the media, when that story first broke and they discovered the identities of the women, they were decomposed, but they eventually discovered them. They were pretty much labeled as black, crack-addicted prostitutes. In fact, one mainstream paper called them literally crack whores.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got me interested in the story, because when I went to talk to their family members, their mothers, sisters, children, and you start putting together the pieces of their lives, and they're very human. They had jobs, they owned homes, they had families, and they got hooked up on drugs. And Wayne, I came to find out in a lot of cases it was the men in their lives that got them hooked on drugs.
Oh, yes.
And then the guy was an addict too, and he would put his woman out on the street to barter her body for drugs.
Yes, right.
In a lot of cases, they were used like that. So go ahead.
I apologize. You go, please.
Well, as I was going to say, and I'm sorry. They were victims of a serial killer, but they were also victims of the environment that they lived in. The poverty-stricken environment they lived in, with very few social services, not much of a social net. Almost all of them had been in rehab at one point or another. They'd spend 28 days in there. They'd get done, and guess what? They'd go right back to the neighborhood that they lived in before, with really no jobs to speak of, and no follow-up support try to help them to keep from making the same, decisions they had made before.
Yeah, it goes back to how we kind of stole this topic, too. It goes back to easy prevalence of crack cocaine in their cities. And, we have a book written by a really good author, a newspaper reporter, Mr. Webb, right, that documents, from the court documents, that it was, in fact, the CIA working with the Contras to bring in tons of cocaine into their city in the most easily victimized population in the world, get them addicted on drugs to perhaps, tax them, then use that money to conduct a horrific civil war in Central America. It's just, in one level, it's sickening. In another level, it's fascinating.
That guy, he was vilified.
Yes, he was.
He was vilified for his reporting. And now I think that we're finding out that, maybe he was right. We're coming up with evidence that he was right.
In my opinion, and you can read his book, Dark Lions, where he documents where he gets his information from. Therefore, the court records are open to anybody who wants to take the time to get them. There's a fee if you want so many pages of them, but they are open, right? If people want to know, but the first thing we have to do, and I'm really glad that you're writing and stuff, and other people are as well, is we have to know the information. We have to know about the crimes in such a way where we do more than saying, suddenly we say, oh, it's too bad, and do something else, or switch the channel. Where we want to take action, because I live, and I'll get into my soapbox just for a bit, I live in the city of a Midwest Rust Belt, right? We have a horrific opiate problem, like there's no tomorrow. Every day, people in my neighborhood get victimized. But the city says we have no money to fight this problem. We shut down our bus system because we have no money to pay the bus drivers now. We take down streetlights because we have no money to pay for electricity. But yet, the mayor's friends got $5 million for development that he walked away from. If I walked away from a $5 million debt, I think I'd be in jail. Fascinating.
Ohio actually has the highest number of opioid related deaths in the nation. Not just rate, not per capita, but the highest, higher than California, and much larger states. The theory is that because of our geographical location, we're at the intersection of a lot of major highways. Now, the opioid, it's so bad now that coroners, if it looks like a clear-cut overdose, they won't even do an autopsy. Some cities will not go out on a and provide Narcan anymore to an opioid overdose. We just don't have the money anymore. They have to rent freezer trucks to put the bodies in, to store the bodies. So it's, you know, just a tragedy. Clearly, the war on drugs is not working. I mean, that's been a failure.
It is. And the thing here, it's an interesting topic that we latched into the war on drugs so easily because it's something that, I mean, you write for a newspaper and you do some freelance writing yourself, so are you familiar with the war on drugs? I live in a city. I have family members affected by the opiate problem, right? It is a huge problem that we have to engage, but it's so easy for us not to look at it. And ultimately, if we didn't have a population that wanted that drug, we would not have drugs sold in this country. But I don't know how you convince people not to use that drug to escape.
You'll never do it. In Cleveland, there's certain sections of Cleveland, inner city Cleveland, Rust Belt City also, where you can drive for a mile or so, and you can see the remnants of what used to be retail, a commercial district, but is now boarded up. Now you got check cashing, you've got pawn shops, maybe a liquor store here or there. But then you drive around and you think, well, where would these poor young people work? What job other than working in a fast food place would be available to them? I mean, you'd be the most conservative person in the world, and you still have to admit once you drive through this neighborhood, there's not a lot of economic opportunity.
Right.
We had white flight in Cleveland in the 70s, where the white people just left for the suburbs. But even more damaging was black flight. We had a African-American mayor, Carl Stokes, who made a lot of opportunities for black people in terms of city jobs, school board jobs. And once they got those jobs, they ascended to the middle class, let's say, they left too.
Yes.
So now what's left is people with very little opportunity. Now what's left in those neighborhoods is youth without any real role models. I mean, if you talk to them, who do they have to respect? Dad left, mom's on drugs, grandma raised them. The only guys they see that seem to have any kind of net worth or sense of accomplishment or prestige or drug dealers. So what role models, who is there for them to respect?
Correct.
It's not a great situation.
No, it's not. And we do have efforts from black African-American leaders to educate. Are you familiar with the singer 50 Cent?
Well, yes. Yes, I am.
I mean, he wrote a book and a graphic novel geared at African-American teen males, showing them that with hard work and effort, they can do anything they want to. And he uses his own story not to say, be a drug dealer like me, but he uses his own story to say, don't be a screw-up like me. Use those skills that you have now and can get to do better.
I don't know, though, is that even realistic? In the city of Cleveland, so many tax abatements have been given to developers. They build, they use public dollars to build private facilities like our football stadiums,
uh-huh.
Our basketball arenas. Billionaire sports owners get those facilities paid for, or they get them rented to them at very low cost, well, those tax dollars that you've gone to schools are abated. So,
yes, sir.
If you are an accomplishment, you know, an achiever in school, you don't have a lot of company, and maybe, you know, you're going to get preyed on. If you drive by a housing subdivision, a Section 8, you know, low-income housing subdivision in Cleveland, you can, you know, there's an aura of danger. There's an aura of danger. There seems to be a lot of obstacles to breaking out of that light.
Oh, yes, sir.
I'm not sure how you could do it, how you could pull yourself up by your own bootstraps to do that.
And that's a damn good question, because I don't know either. And you spoke so clearly. I mean, the state of Wisconsin, the city of Milwaukee County gave the new Buck owners, were billionaires, both of them, well over several hundred, I think $600 million of tax money for an arena. Wait a second, they're billionaires. They bought the Bucks, which is a team worth billions. But the state's going to give them money for an arena, so people who lived in the arena can't afford to go. But yet, in Milwaukee, as the worst school systems in the state, the worst public transportation in the state, roads suck like shit. Oh, they had to pass wheel tax both at the city and the county level in order to play for police force that we can't hire because they'd rather have an ice cream truck. And they wonder why people who can leave do leave.
Our owner, the owner of the Cavaliers, doesn't even live in Cleveland. He's from Detroit. I mean,
well,
those jobs that are created by those developments, they're low-paying jobs.
Right. Oh, yeah.
They're minimum-wage jobs.
We're going to consider a scene. Well, we're $200 million in debt. We discussed our non-bus system, our non-lights and stuff, right? We won't repeat those words. We're going to build an arena and a hotel complex for $50 million in the hopes that somebody from Chicago, which is 90 miles away, will want to come to Racine for a D-League basketball team. Oh, I'm sorry, that got relocated from Northern Wisconsin to a hockey league team, which is Bloor class and even the Admirals, right? But because they get told by consultants that the city pays for, after they get a consulting study, that will make the difference in the jobs. But when does a consulting company ever get to be rehired if they ever tell a city that's a really stupid idea?
Right.
It's just incredible. But again, going back to true crime, I mean, we have, as citizens, like you, I'm not calling myself a journalist, because God knows I'm not one, right? God knows I won't be a writer better than my dogs ever will be, right? But we have people out there who want to be, who see things around themselves, and you want to write about this, the crime issue, because it is a crime that we have a heroin problem. It's a horrific crime that we have all these other problems where poverty pimps are making a fortune that should go to these programs to feed kids in grade schools. So for these people out there that want to start writing true crime books or even fictional crime books as a way to educate the public what's going on, what advice would you give them?
Well, so if you want to use true crime as a sort of a platform to address some social issues or concerns, that's what we're looking at there. I would say, yeah, that can be done, but your publishers these days, unless you self-publish, they want to slot a book. They want that book to fit securely in a certain genre. So you're going to have to really be creative in injecting your commentary into that story. Because anytime you do that, you've got to slow the story down. There's the true crime genre, they kind of call it, you know, the ugly stepchild of the publishing industry. It's kind of porn in a sense. It's kind of gratuitous. There's always a market for it. You can see that on TV by all the TV shows, true crime shows. But, you know, you just got to, you know, pick and choose your spots where you can throw the commentary in. But, yeah, I would say it's a pretty good way of doing it because you already got a built-in audience. And then you're going to have to address the topic that's interesting to you. Mine was, drugs, the effect of drugs in the community. But, there's just got to be a concerted effort to try to help the people that are the most vulnerable to drugs. And I don't know if that can even be done. I mean, it's such a huge problem. It's generational. I mean, it's systemic. When my crime occurred on Imperial Avenue in Cleveland, not a real long street, but long enough. So I knocked on every door in that street to, gather information. And then I'd go home and I'd do Google, because court records are available. And I'd look, and almost everybody I talked to had a court case, a drug case. And along with the drug case comes receiving stolen property and, things like that, because you got to finance your habit, of course. But it's just not, in some neighborhoods and some communities, it's not such a stigma to have a criminal record. I mean, it's almost a rite of passage, or it's expected. So, there's a whole mindset there that it's hard to overcome. And secondly, the police kind of have a rough job of it in the inner city. The people that live in a community or neighborhood have to be their eyes and ears in a lot of cases. They have to be the antennas and let them know what's happening. And, there's a real reluctance to interact with the police in that regard. Naturally, you don't want to be considered a snitch, but even more importantly than that, maybe you got some own criminal issues of your own that you don't really want to get involved with the police, because, those could come to light. So, there's a mutual distrust, at least in the city I live in, of between the police and the community. And, that's not getting any better, and that might be hard to overcome. We have to overcome it, of course, but it's going to be tough. So those are all social issues that, yes, could be incorporated into a true crime book. But you're going to have to be willing to try to be a good storyteller, and yet also, interpolate some of this material into it. It's kind of a little bit of a technique there. It takes a lot of time. You said earlier, it's a tremendous amount of time. Yeah, it is. It's a real commitment, and there's no money in it. Just really no money in it. For different reasons, publishing's tough. It's competitive. There's just so much product out there that you have to not only be a. You end up being a marketer who wrote a book. Because now you got to get out. You got to get out and hump your book. And fortunately, thanks to, generous, passionate people like you who are willing to give authors, time, airtime, thank God there's people like you, because it helps. It helps to get the story out, to differentiate yourself from so many other authors and books that are out there.
Well, I'm happy to bring in authors and have them talk, because God knows, if I may admit a guilty sin, I love to be a writer myself, and I'm just too scared and too cowardly to do it. Anyway, yet we have brave men and women, these are an example, that do the writing stuff that I wish I could do. And frankly, I need to do that myself, because using Racine as an example, a lot of our problems we have as a city comes because we have such a poor city government. And the documentation is there to show it's a poor city government. And I think that we have enough people in City of Racine who wouldn't know how the hell we got in the state, that if I sold my books on Amazon, for a couple bucks, that I would sell enough to at least fund my next effort. Does that make sense, or am I totally insane?
No, it does. And I think the average author, I read a figure, I could be wrong, but it sells about 1,500 to 2,000 books. It's probably lower than that, but let's just say it's 2,000, and you want to be a writer, okay? So let's say you want to write true crime, and You can go through a mainstream publisher, but you're going to get about 8 to 10% of the net price of the book as a royalty.
Right.
Now, most Amazon's going to want about 50%. They want a discount of about 50% to sell the book. So let's say you got a $20 book. That's $10 net. You're going to get about 8% of that. It's 80 cents a book. Now, if you self-publish, it's going to cost you about maybe $5, $6 on Amazon. You're going to keep the rest. So 2,000 books times $15, that's $30,000. However, yes, you're going to make much more money, but you got to get out there and market it. You're not going to be in a bookstore because bookstores don't stock self-published books. You're not going to be in a library. And there's still a little stigma about self-published books. However, you get the book out there quicker. You own it. It's actually worth your while to promote it. So that's a decision you got to make as an author too. A very important decision. Because there are some very good self-published. Yeah, marketing, right. You've got to be willing to do the press releases and try to get libraries to have you speak and social media, just, you know, be a pest on social media. It's another thing to consider.
Right. And the idea is, what's a pest? I mean, I find using Twitter as an example, if someone tweets by my book, Iraq, that to me is a pest. If an author says, like your statement you said earlier, Ohio is the largest state with the biggest opioid problem. My book talks about it. I'll click on that link. I'll look at your book and say, geez, that's a book. Maybe I can find it in my library, or if I can find it someplace else, or if it's self-published, I'll buy it in a heartbeat because I'm supporting an author. I read a book on a subject I'm interested in. It all depends on how it's said. And yes, marketing is difficult. In the Midwest, we're both from the Midwest, we're taught early on that if you promote yourself, you're a bad person. It's hard to say many people stick with that idea.
I agree with that.
Yeah, we kind of drift around topics, and I apologize for that, sir. But so before we end the show, let me tell the audience where they can find your great books. And there's such great books, I recommend them all.
House of Horrors. That is actually, I won a 2012 True Crime Book of the Year award at the American Library Association. That's available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Probably libraries can order that, of course, too. And then my second book, Badge 387, the story of Jim Simone, a very highly decorated cop. That's also Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever books are sold. I did write a mob book that I self-published.
Yeah, mob book.
Yeah, Mystery of the Lufthansa Heist. That was the Lufthansa Airlines heist in the 70s. That was the basis of the movie Goodfellas by Martin Scorsese. That book actually, for at least a couple months, actually made some money on. True crime, mob books have a built-in audience. There's a customer base for them. And that was an interesting book. I mean, the mob will never go out of style in terms of movies and readership. People just seem to really enjoy, dipping into that lifestyle and then, immersing themselves in it. Fascinating world.
People, for whatever reason, quickly believe that Tony Soprano is true on TV, and we can debate, as I have with others, the role of mafia and crime today. But the crime that sometimes romanticized is not the true crime that actually exists.
Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, directors, they probably have done a disservice to us by casting good-looking, charismatic actors in the role of mobsters. I mean, Pacino, Brando, De Niro, they've in a sense, almost kind of idealize these people when, you know, we know they're killers. I mean, some of them are just as sociopathic as serial killers that we have, you know, plaguing society. But, you know, they package them up and they make them glossy and make them very attractive, and it's entertainment.
It's entertainment, right. Everything is entertainment. Actually, we look at it. And again, you know, in the casino, they didn't talk about all the people that died. So they kind of hinted at the end, but a lot of people died in that. And maybe a lot of them deserved it, I don't know, but a lot of people that didn't deserve it also got killed. And then that takes Holly to our...
Absolutely. Wayne, you know about the two cops in New York. Ippolito was one of them, and I can't remember the other's name, Calavetta maybe. They were police detectives who were affiliated with the mob up there, and they were killers. They'd kill people, and in one case, the mob asked them to get an ID on an individual they wanted killed. They got a guy with the same name, gave that name, and that innocent person got killed.
Yep.
I mean, it happens. Innocent people get killed.
Absolutely, all the
yes.
time. And the thing is, I mean, I do the show, The Milwaukee Mob, where we talk about mob killings and mob figures, and it is quite a bit romanticized when we talk about what happened in the 40s and 50s, like with Little Rack. We'll be doing about New Orleans and the links of New Orleans to the JFK killing, right? Assassination. And the CBS
mm-hmm.
wars. But that also speaks of history. You know, and it's idea of two, which we kind of talked about before the show started as well, sir, is if when we lose history, where we need writers, where we need books, where we need authors, is when we lose the idea of what history is, we're lesser people.
Absolutely. Yes, organized crime is a part of our history.
Yes.
One, we could almost say an important part of our history. But, yeah, I mean, it appeals to a sense, that sense of power and, you know, just unbridled ability to assert one's will. I mean, I guess we all have, we like to live vicariously through that, the fact that, you know, when we have enemies, we ignore them or gossip about them. These guys just go out and kill them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's probably a little part of all of us that, you know, would want to do that to some of our worst enemies.
We could talk about the roofers. We dealt with here about that, too. And I had the pleasure of talking to an old school man. I don't think it was made man, Gunther. He served 12, 13 years in a Michigan prison for what he did, right? And yeah, he's doing better now. He's really changed his life. He's devoted his life to God. He's doing a lot of interesting things out there, helping a lot of people out. And he tells very funny stories about what it's like to rob a drug dealer. You laugh at them. They're hilarious because we all would like to see that drug dealer taken down because we see the horrific effects that drugs play, right? But I suspect that if he could take it all back and not go to jail for 12 years, he'd do so in a heartbeat.
Yes. Yes,
so,
but that's got to be a very, very seductive lifestyle for a mobster.
Yeah,
being able to make that kind of money with, you know, not being a 9-to-5er.
Right, and you're taking advantage of scum. To me, most of these black drug dealers he was ripping off were also pimps. You know, taking advantage of women, as that serial killer that you wrote about did. And I think that, yeah, the mafia guy is out there, he's doing these, you know, he's doing these bad things, but they're horrible people. Who cares? You know, but there's way more to it than that. But I do thank you so much for being on my show. I apologize for drifting so much off topic, but I do think we had a hell of a show.
Oh, it was a great show. It's a fascinating talk to you. I really appreciate you having me on, Clint Wayne. Thank you.
Well, My pleasure. We'll talk again soon, and this time we'll try to keep it better on topic. And I thank you for your day, sir, and with that, you have a good one.
You also. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. A great show. Go and buy his books. You will not be disappointed. He's one of you and me. I should have gotten his Facebook. We can find him on Twitter. from you. Go to my show link. You can find it. Search his name. He'll be on Twitter. I know. I lie. He's not on Twitter. He's on Facebook. You can find him on Facebook and get his books from there. And please do so. You will not be disappointed. Again, I thank everybody for listening to the show. And with that, everybody have a great day. Bye.